Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Pop Culture Uncovered. Well, I have to be honest, I really wish we had another 3 hours to be able to cover everything, seeing right. how we literally are taking a 3 hour movie and about a 2.5 hour movie and smashing them together and trying to cover everything. Continuing along the lines of differences in the films, really quickly, I want us to talk about two other characters that there's such massive differences between the two versions of the movies. We have to mention mm-hmm. it. One is Dr. Yui, who is played by Dean Stockwell in Dune 1984, and is played by Chang Chen in Dune Part 1. Now, I will say this. Dean Stockwell somehow got better dialogue in Dune 84 than what was provided, you know, in Dune Part 1 for Mr. Chen. There's just no way of getting past it. With Dean Stockwell's character, there's enough time for the betrayal to feel painful. Where Dr. Yui's betrayal, and I'm not going into the details of the betrayal, but just that there's a betrayal. But Dr. Yui's betrayal in Dune Part 1 is kind of so lackluster. So that's one. And two is Jessica. Because I feel like the thing that really elevates Dune Part 1, if I was going to say there was anything that I loved more about one movie over than the other, it's the fact that the book always kind of quietly alludes to the fact that Paul lost the parent who really loved him best, that he was the most comfortable with in terms of being himself. And I felt like, you know, Jessica Ferguson's performance, which I thought was masterful, because Frances Ann was not getting a lot to work with as Jessica in Dune. There are literally scenes where she's literally reduced to, no, he's dead. Leto is dead. Where obviously they gave much better dialogue to Jessica Ferguson, but there's a wonderful moment that occurs in Dune Part 1 that is nowhere in the original Dune, where Paul snaps and is like, I'm a freak. I'm a freak and it's your fault. You did this to me. Jessica Ferguson, I'm sorry. Rebecca Ferguson, sorry. Scrambling names, my fault. Rebecca Ferguson, of course, for the uninitiated, you've probably seen her in the Mission Impossible series and a whole bunch of other fantastic performances. But no, I thought she somehow managed to mix vulnerability, being a mother, being a absolutely terrifying Bene Gesserit, and weaving it all together in a way that made Jessica, if I had to pick a version of that character, I'm picking the one in Dune Part 1. Because that's the version where I'm like, oh yeah, Paul's looking at his mother like, you and I might be adversaries at some point down the road. I make no assumptions that we're always going to be on good terms. Pete, go ahead.
There's a weight to that character that it feels like it was never going to exist in the 80s. And in this Dune, there's almost a quiet menace to her where, yeah, there's a genuine affection, you know, between, you know, Paul and his father. But with Lady Jessica, there's an arm's length, you know, even when they're trapped, even, you know, when their struggle is shared, even when she's trying to guide him, even when she's trying to, you know, it also feels like she's trying to gauge him. Obviously, in both versions, you know, there's the part of her that is teaching him, but there's a genuine, like, very quiet menace to this portrayal, Lady Jessica.
One of the things, Yui is so disappointing for multiple reasons. The actor is perfectly cast. So I have issues with both versions of Yui, because one of the things about Frank Herbert's books that made it stand out for a book that is older than I have been alive is that he made a point of describing these as people of the global majority. The Fremen, Dr. Yui, the other houses of the Landsred. In the 1984 version, everyone's white. Every character is white, and they shouldn't be. Literally, even it's one of those things where we are literally in the source material, and y'all still manage to whitewash us. Dr. Yui as Dean Stockwell, but the thing is, Dean Stockwell's performance is so phenomenal in that film, and as you said, his dialogue, his performance is so much better. That while the casting is physically correct, and the actor gives a great performance in Dune Part One, he isn't given the depth that we have in the first one. So Yui is, both Yuis cancel each other out for me. Jessica, they have not failed in the casting of Jessica in any version, whether it's the 1984 version, whether it's the Sci-Fi Channel version with Alex Krieg, whether it's this one. Every version of Jessica is cast wonderfully. Oh, yeah,
that one.
Every version, you believe that she can beat the brakes off of whomever comes up on her in every version. Whether she got the dialogue to back her up is a different story. So every version of Jessica rocks to the point where I don't mind any of them. I think that both the miniseries and 2000, the Dune Part One version, give her a lot. She's a lot closer to book Jessica. Jessica is one of the most powerful fighters, most powerful people in the Dune universe. You have to remember that beyond the fact that she's a Bene Gesserit, her hand-to-hand skills are unmatched. What I mean by that is the Satyrkar tried it and found out the hard way that they were not built to take on the Fremen. The Satyrkar are the ones that everybody is afraid of in the Landsraad. In the Dune universe, everybody's afraid of the Satyrkar. They go to Dune and get the brakes beat off of them by the Fremen. Jessica beats the brakes off the Fremen. In the 1984 version, we don't get this. She has moments, but we don't really get to see her really lay that physical smack down. She relies mostly on her Bene Gesserit abilities. So I really like that we get to see her be a fighter in this one. Jessica's also extremely tragic. This character is tragic because she actually fell in love, and Bene Gesserits are not supposed to fall in love with the Mark. They're not supposed to, but she actually loves Leto. And so that shows in every version that she genuinely, absolutely adores her husband and her child. But to your point, Armand, about her relationship with Paul, she's afraid of him because she knows what she's done. She knows that her love allowed her to create something that she, not only can she not control, but that is going to outstrip her in ways that can go from oh, you always want your kid to be better to you than you, to, oh no, I've created a monster. And so there's that moment in Dune Part One, to your point, where he goes off and he goes silence and he makes her, and that's when you see the fear in her eyes that he was able to make her not talk. That moment sent chills down my spine. So I think Jessica is such a tragic figure for multiple reasons, but suffice to say, I really enjoy all of the versions of her, and I really am looking forward to how they handle her pregnancy in Part Two.
Okay, now I want to jump to what might be the single most significant, most important difference between Dune 84 and Dune Part One, and that's the prophecy. So in Dune 84, the prophecy of the voice, you know, from the outer world that's going to come and lead the Fremen to freedom, that is taken as gospel faith. The prophecy is a real thing. Paul is the fulfillment of it. The Fremen falling in behind him and his inevitable success, which in Dune 84 leads to a happy utopia. Right. That is very different. I mean, that is an invention that is so far away from what's in the book as to be almost a complete and total different thing. And that's that opposed to what I feel like Dune Part One does a great job of. This ain't Star Wars. There ain't no happy rebellion that's coming. Paul is playing with forces that are well beyond his control. He might be the Kwisatz Haderach. He might be the universe's supreme being. That does not mean that he has any capacity or control ability to control what's coming. And it's the fact that Paul can see possible futures that I feel like the Paul that we had in 84, Kyle MacLachlan's Paul, his visions are true. He sees the future. He sees what's going to happen, and he can plan for it. He can embrace it. He can move into it. Dune Part One is like the book. He's seeing possible futures. He's trying to his best of ability to try to shape things in a positive direction, which is what the Bene Gesserit, why they wanted to control the Kwisatz Haderach, just to guide humanity in the best, most positive direction. The problem is, even the Kwisatz Haderach can only guide Obit so much. Which I felt they did a phenomenal job that I feel like only fans of the book will catch is Jameis, where there's one vision where Paul sees Jameis, and Paul and Jameis are friends. And Jameis is like, I will teach you the ways of the Fremen. But Paul's not able to manipulate the events to get to that version of the future. He's left with the version of the future where he has no choice but to kill Jameis. And killing Jameis has down the road consequences for him. So I want to talk about the prophecy because Pete, as I kick it to you, for Dune Part One, it's faithful to the book. And what I mean by that is the Bene Gesserit have been tampering with the religious beliefs of humanity on every planet for thousands of years. They have functionally Afro-turfed everything. In Dune 84, when you see the Reverend Mother talking about, you know, we've done what we can for you. It was never really clear what it was they had done. For Dune Part One, it's we have created a mythology amongst the Fremen that will lead them to believe that any Bene Gesserit with a male child is more than likely the fulfillment of the prophecy. So if you find yourself trapped on Arrakis with no friends and no help and no hope, we have astroturfed so the Fremen will be likely to follow any Bene Gesserit and her son. And Paul has to deal with the moral ramifications of, we haven't seen it yet. That seems like, but that's what the heart of Part Two is going to be about. But Paul has to deal with the moral ramifications of, he's manipulating people. He's not just manipulating people. He's manipulating a culture and a society. And the consequences of that for the universe are grave as they can be. Pete.
I think there's something about Dune Part One that made me excited about it. The prophecy, again, in the 84 version, like everything was so accelerated, like it felt very shortchanged, very accelerated, very oversimplified. And I think the best thing about the direction of that movie was simply the fact that you could see that there was more to it. It was almost like the movie hinted at the fact that like the book was going to tell you more because it just felt very expressed and, you know, in some ways, you know, cliff notes. Whereas you get the complexity, I think, from the very beginning in Dune Part One, when it comes to the prophecy, when it comes to all of the Bene Gesserit storyline, in that, like, this is a gray, it's everyone's gray. Everyone has their own agenda, even people who seem as allied as they could possibly be, and you don't get this foreshadowing feeling that Paul is going to be a great hero, that's going to, like, you even get the feeling early on that this prophecy is doing harm as much as it is good to every person who is implicated in it. And that's something that, I don't know, is refreshing from a storytelling perspective, because it feels bigger. Everything about Dune Part One feels, you know, a lot of money is spent on special effects in movies these days that, you know, people could barely, you know, conceive of in 1984. But I think one of the best things about that, one of the best applications of that, is creating a universe that feels bigger, that feels like this is, you know, this is a society that has been going on for thousands of years with all of these different worlds getting involved. And the hugeness of that, I think, is makes that the whole idea of the prophecy feel even bigger, feel like it's been going and building up for such a long time, that I feel like you get the scope of it, and that's a fun ride. I think, whereas I feel like I didn't really understand it nearly as well with the, you know, the 1984 movie. But again, that was a movie I watched since I was a kid. So this fresh kind of direction also gives me a chance to enjoy Dune as though it's new. And that has to do with a lot of things, but this part of the story in particular.
Bell, your thoughts on the differences in the prophecy between Dune and Dune, well, Dune 84 and Dune Part 1.
Dune Part 1 leans into what Herbert was doing from jump, which is breaking down the Joseph Campbell hero's journey and taking it to its logical conclusion. What happens when, no matter how incorruptible pureness the character is, they're given absolute power and an army? And so Dune Part 1 starts hinting, as Pete said, very early on, that this prophecy, that all prophecies, much like with Greek tragedy, with any classical literature, prophecies can be interpreted many different ways. Man-made or woman-made, as it were, prophecies can be interpreted many different ways. And the Bene Gesserit spent thousands of years seeding this prophecy on every planet they could get to and never thought about what would happen when it came true. And so never, you know, they wanted to make sure that they had their genetically perfect super being, and they are a force for good. They're manipulative, and which is another reason which I really appreciate very much in Part 1. It's less straightforward than in 1984. The Bene Gesserit are portrayed as straight villains in the 1984 version. Whereas in this one, you see that they are well-intentioned extremists. Does that make sense? They are trying to do what they think is best for everyone because they do get visions of the future. So they're trying to guide it into the least painful path that saves the most lives. Now, the problem becomes, going back to Jessica, that Jessica swerved hard by having a boy instead of a girl. So that changes everything. But the fact remains that Paul, there's a darkness in him that we get to see portrayed. In some ways, I think 1984 touches on it a little bit more directly. There are moments where Paul is terrifying in 1984 that he's not in the 2021 version. There are moments of genuine, oh, this fool man might be insane. And in the 1984 version, because of the things that have happened. So and they do hint that it's not going to be all hunky-dory with Aaliyah, with his little sister, and the way she's going around stabbing everybody like a lunatic.
You're talking about Saint Aaliyah of the Knife?
Yeah, little baby Aaliyah, right, who's like 4 years old, murdering everybody in sight. I think that it's so rushed in 84 that they felt, because they were pressured both by the studio and by the, which is why you don't do test audiences, to give it a happy ending, because this is the years post A New Hope. And when this movie is basically Empire Strikes Back, but times 11. And so the prophecy, I think that they're going to handle it better in this one, just because they're giving the room the space to breathe. And they're allowing the characters to be dark. To Pete's point, there were shades of gray in the first film, But this one seems to really be digging into it and how there is no clear cut. The only characters who are truly unrepentantly evil are the Harkonnens. And even that, when you know some of the backstory, can be kind of laid at the Emperor's feet because of his own manipulations.
Yeah, I was actually going to say the Harkonnens actually come off being nicer in Dune in this, Part 1.
Than they are in the books or in 94, 84. Yeah.
Yeah, because in 84, they're just straight flat out villains. And in this one, it's more like it's Game of Thrones in space, which is really what Dune was to begin with. But because we're running out of time, there's one last thing I want us to touch on before we go, and that's the visuals. And the reason why it's important for us to talk about the visuals before we go is I feel like the visuals themselves led to rather significant choices about that shaped both films. So I'll say for Dune 84, one, I feel like their ambitions exceeded their grasp. The technology was not there. I felt like they did everything they could get away with the technology as it was. And in that, it is a success and a failure simultaneously. Because as a kid, I was like, this ain't all working. But God, the stuff that they're trying is just awesome. You know, seeing seeing Emperor Shaddam IV's golden ship come in and land, I was like, it ain't really hitting the way it's supposed to. But man, is it hitting though. And specifically, the Spacing Guild, because the one thing that I will tell you that Dune Part 1 I think fails to do is to explain that why the spice is so important, what the long-term consequences of spice usage are, why spice is the fundamental cornerstone of human existence now. Dune 84 establishes that the first time you see the Spacing Guild. Spice is so important, they got dudes with vacuum cleaners to suck up all the leftover spice from the level 3 Space Guild navigator talking to the Emperor. And you can just look at the guys, you're like, okay, so whatever's in that glass box, that used to be human and it is very different now. But all the dudes around this thing don't look like regular people anymore either. So it was one of those like, oh, it literally, the visuals and the special effects literally keyed you off on the idea of, you know, you might not want to really mess with spice. Spice itself has some consequences, which I feel like the book did a phenomenal job. Because if you read the book tells you spice is a poison. Because by the time your eyes turn blue and you look like a Fremen, congratulations, you a crackhead. Now you're going to live on Arrakis for the rest of your life. Because if you don't get spice, you're going to die. Because your body's dependent upon it now. And the spice is in the air and everything else, and it's a wrap. Dune 81 literally had Kyle MacLachlan eating a piece of spice like it was a Mike and Ike. I mean, literally, but that's what it looks like. It looks like an orange Mike and Ike. And I felt like that was my problem with the visuals, even down to the Gum Jabbar and the pain in the box, because the visuals showed me Paul suffering in a way that clarified the threat that he was under and the threat that Paul must have posed. Because to test somebody like that, to where it's the, you feel your flesh crispening. Like, we've left the, my hand is cut wide open and it's bleeding. It's the, you're telling me my hand's been on fire so long, but now my hand's like burnt steak. And so the visuals, I felt like Lynch created visuals that in their own unique way fill in the gaps where the story, where like they couldn't give you enough stuff on film, right? Like, we'll give you this visual that will help you understand 45 pages of the book that you won't get a chance to read and about an hour and a half of stuff that we don't have time to film. Where I feel like Dune Part 1, to be perfectly honest, it's what I wish. Okay, I know I'm gonna butcher his last name. Somebody correct me. Dennis's last name is Villanueva. Thank you. It looked like a Denis Villeneuve film. For me, I'm like, I can draw a straight line between Blade Runner 2049 and Dune Part 1 and say, okay, I would expect that guy would produce this. There's nothing wrong with it. I think it works on some levels. I will say I thought the Fremen suits actually looked better in Dune Part 1 than they did elsewhere. But so yeah, I think the visuals, there were very different visual choices made in between the two. The last thing I'll say before I kick it to y'all, so we can go ahead and close it up. I did think Doom Part 1 did a better job of showing there's no artificial intelligence and computers. All the computers are dumb. And I wish they would have touched on it a little bit more. That's why Thufir is so special, because Mentats are living computers now, which I feel like neither film has really successfully really handled the Mentats yet. And I don't know if it's because they're too cerebral for an American audience to get. If maybe this was a purely European production, we would get a better throw at it. But Bell, I know you're a hard sci-fi fan and visuals matter to you. You know, what did you think about the different choices between the two movies?
I actually thought that the first film in 1984, the costumes are freaking sumptuous. They are lush. The costumes, the hair, the choices of colors. Irulan's dress alone is enough for me to come back to watch that. The detailing of the outfits are just gorgeous. As I said from the top, the visual of the space navigator showing up was so terrifying to me as a kid. And to this day, it's still one of the most disturbing things I've ever seen put to film. Because you know, like you said, you know it used to be a human being. It ain't no more. But we know it used to be. I think that part one did a great job of referencing the cultures that it was pulling from, especially once they got to the desert planet. So I think that they both were gorgeous visually. They were doing very different things. And so I really enjoyed how part one, especially once they got to Arrakis, the clothing choices, whereas in the 1984 film, there's no change in the way they dress, which there should have been. They went from a water planet to a desert planet. There should have been a change in how they were dressed and how they presented themselves. But I really enjoyed both the visuals. There was nothing as disturbing in the Doom Part One for me as multiple visuals, the Baron Harkonnen's everything in 1984. Everything involving the Harkonnens upset me on every level. So there's nothing as visually disturbing in the new one. I'm waiting to see if they go there in part two.
When it comes to the world, when it comes to the visuals and special effects, I think what I see in Doom Part One is there's a lot of conventional sci-fi stuff. The equipment, the weapons, the vehicles, everything's very clever and is designed in a way that you know, again, reflects a big universe. And I like to see that the differences, like culturally, between the things that you see, from the clothing to, you know, again, the vehicles, the technology, but there's something so great about the weirdness that you see in Lynch's that just, it makes it special, you know, like the idea that like spice has this physical effect, that it has had, like that it has changed our evolution, is something that's just so strange. And I think one of the things that is just so great about David Lynch and the power of his visuals is, even it doesn't even feel like it comes out of his brain. It feels like he's found the exact right people to convey something. He picks the right collaborators, you know, in the set design, in the costume design, in the creature work, that it feels very alien. And I think that's the thing that Dune always feels a little off kilter, and I like that it feels that way. Dune is weird, is, you know, engaging in a strange way, and I think visually it has to do the same thing. I think you lose a little bit by having a conventional sci-fi style that could fit anywhere and be applied to anything. I think you've got to go weirder if you're doing Dune. You have to embrace the weird. And there are elements that are there in part one. But I want it in more places.
Well, I really am sad that we're at the end of this episode, because let me just bullet point for you all the things that we didn't get a chance to talk about. Weirding modules. Wonderful invention in 84. Completely non-existent in part one, because they're not even mentioned or referenced in the book, and it was entirely an invention. The differences between the hunter-seeker drone, which in Dune 84, everybody felt like, I can stand still and grab this stupid thing, as compared to part one, where you're like, there's a needle pointed at my eye. Seriously. So no, I mean, Dune is a very, very rich... I mean, look, when it comes to, I mean, it's Dune is Lord of the Rings for sci-fi fans, period. So is about as rich as it can come, because I'd be remiss if I didn't tell you, when we're watching Dune, remember, you're dropping into the middle of a story that's been going on for about 10,000 years. And there's so much stuff like Bell, the butler in Jahad, that things that go unexplained that, you know, that you're like, oh, you got to read the book. And not just the original book. You got to read the books to be able to understand all of it. And I think that's one of the things that makes Dune such an exceptional franchise. Because I will say, and this is a little bit of political commentary, living in a country where people don't read, it's refreshing to have pop culture that's kind of like, if you read the books, well, you get a lot out of this. If not, you know, hey, you know, you got your middle school level reading level. You can figure out what the dialogue says in the movie, but you do get infinitely a lot more if you read the Frank Herbert books to start with and the Brian Herbert books that kind of fill in some of the holes based off his father's notes. But regardless, if you like Dune, I will tell you the 40th anniversary reissue, you can go see Dune 84 on big screens now before it's too late. I think that actually ends... over the course of this weekend. So hope you get a chance to check that out. Same thing for the reissuance of Dune Part 1. It's back on IMAX for 1 week only. I checked it out. Definitely would recommend it. And I would tell you, if you're going to buy tickets to go see Dune Part 2, I would tell you to shell out the extra money to watch it in IMAX. You'll be able to watch it, you know, standard format on HBO Max or whatever the hell they're calling that service before you know it. But I think Dune is worth seeing. It reminds me a lot of Oppenheimer. Some things really do work best in IMAX in terms of scope and visuals. And I think that's very true for Dune. But if you've enjoyed this podcast, I have wonderful news for you. Belle and I have press passes to see Dune on February 26th. I will pretend not to be annoyed at the fact that you can buy tickets for the fan celebration for the 25th. So in other words, as a fan, you can go see Dune before I can go see Dune with my press pass. But irregardless, we will have a hot and crispy Dune review, spice filled with the spice melange right there sitting in your hands. So as soon as we get out the movie, Belle's going to make me record a podcast right off the bat. So we'll get that to you as fast as we can, because I genuinely am going to be rocking my Zendaya Kills Everybody t-shirt. That's just me. So... for Belle and for Pete, thank you very much for listening to another episode of Pop Culture Uncovered. We definitely need your support. We've been doing this podcast for a long time. Obviously, it's not cheap to do a podcast. Definitely ask that if you like what we do, or if you like Pete, or you like Belle, or if you'd like for me to shut up, you should support us on Patreon. Patreon is phenomenally cheap. It's $1. We are constantly growing and improving on YouTube, so definitely check out our YouTube channel. And of course, you can listen to this podcast wherever you listen to great podcasts, because this is a great podcast. So for Belle and Pete, this is Armand. I'm reminding you that fear really is the mind killer. Don't move your neck if there's a Gum Jabbar next to it, and always be where Duncan is. Because if you're where Duncan is, you're going to have a fighting chance. On that note, we'll see you on the planet Arrakis very soon. Peace.